All right, we're beginning here with the two dots on the top of Chavchet Amud Aleph. We're speaking about in the Mishnah with regards to the Bechor that gets a mum, just as Chazara, Bechor is one of the Matnot Kihuna. In the time of the Beit HaMikdash, a Bechor Tam is given to the Kohen. It's given to him after the requisite amount of time that is mentioned in our Mishnah. And then the Kohen takes it up to Yerushalayim and brings it as a Korban, Toch Shnato. In its first year of its life, he brings it as a Korban Shlamim. In the Mikdash, he is the Balim of that Korban. If it gets a mum in it, then it is Chulin. It no longer has any Kedusha. There are some restrictions, as we've seen, with regards to what you can do with a Bechor Balmum. But the rites then take it away from the Mizbeach, and it's a Matnot Kuna that the Kohen can eat in his local area. Meaning that there's no requirements of bringing it up to the Mizbeach. And then he can benefit from it, but it's also chulin to the point that he could sell it to someone or he could utilize it for whatever he wants. There are limitations. You can't do certain things with it because of the kedushat bechor that was associated with it. Once you're post the korban, then there's only one option because there's no longer the option of the bechor tam to go on the mizbeach. There's only the option of the bechor bal mum, and so you have to wait for a mum in it. Who has to wait for the mum is a good question, which will come out here a little bit in the Machloket Rishonim with regards to this sugya. In addition, Bechor Balmum today goes to the Kohen because it's still part of the Matnot Kuna. The only time that it doesn't go to the Kohen is when you have a Safek Bechor. If it's a Safek Bechor, then the Mum takes away the Kedusha, and then it leaves you with an issue of Safek, and then we say Motzi Mechavero Lavaraya, and remains with the original Balim, not with the Kohen because of that, because the monetary side stays with the Israel. Once it gets a mum in it, it's chulin, and even the Israel can eat it. The only question is, gezel ha-shevet, stealing from the Kohen, but over here, the Kohen has no rights or proof to that, because of motzi mechavero lavaraya. Now the Gemara asks about the Mishnah, Yibailuhu. Heche kamar. In our Mishnah, the Mishnah has a phraseology, which is somewhat cryptic. It says, no lo dom mum, betok shnato. If it gets a mum within its year, rashay lekaimo, kol shnei masar chodesh. You're allowed to keep it for 12 months, or basically the year of the life of the Bechor. And then there was a lot of different girsaot over here, but it seems to be lachar shnato, after its year, in Rosh Hashanah kaimo l'leyam idyom. You only keep it for 30 days. Now, the lachar shnato, is that an independent clause, or is that a continuation of the previous statement in the Mishnah? And that's what the Gemara is clearing now. Hey, kamar, no lo lo mum betok shnato, if it gets a mum within its year. You can keep it for the whole 12 months. And in addition to that, you can keep it another 30 days after the year has elapsed. Meaning that you have additional 30 days after the year has elapsed. So it's really 12 months plus 30 days. Odilma, or maybe the way to parse it is, that's one din. That if you get a mum within the first year of its life, you can keep it to the end of that year. Been too long. And after that, you can't keep it any longer. And then if he got a mum after the year elapsed, then he can only keep it for 30 days. So the question in the Mishnah is, when it says, after its year, he only can keep it 30 days, is that a continuation of the previous phrase, which said that he keeps it for 12 months? And it says, after the 12 months elapse, you get a 30 days, meaning there's a 30-day countdown. Or, is it a totally independent clause? Which is that 12 months is what happens when you get the mum within the 12 months. 30 days is after the charshnato. If the mum happened after the shana elapsed, then you only get 30 days. You don't get a year from that period in time. So that's the question that is being posed by the Gemara. The Gemara now brings a braita to prove which of these two options it is. Tashma, the Tanya. Bechor b'zman hazeh. So already the Braita is dealing with the Bechor b'zman hazeh, which means there's only one option now. That's for it to get a mum and to be given to the Kohen. Ad shin lo nir el haroto l'chacham. If it still has yet to be brought to the Chacham to show him the mum. Rashi claims over here means shelo nafal bo mum. It doesn't have a mum in it. Then, Rashai the Kaimo, he can keep it around Shtayim v'shalosh shanim, 2 or 3 years. The question that you have to ask on the Braita before you even get any further is, what is the question? What does it mean, Rashai the Kaimo, Shtayim v'shalosh shanim? What exactly do you want him to do with it? It doesn't have a moment at yet, according to Rashi. It's in the hands of the Israel. And so what's he supposed to do with it? There's nothing you can do with this Bechor except wait. So then what does it mean? You are permitted to keep it for 2 or 3 years. That's a issue with the way that Rashi explains it. The Rabbeinu Gershom already dealt with this on the previous Amud when he was describing what he thought the case of the Mishnah was. And he explains that the word Rashai here does not mean permitted, but rather Chayav. He is obligated to keep it. And that's what he says. Hai Rashai de Gamar Chayavu. That Rashai means he is obligated to keep it. Meaning that there's a period of time in which he must keep it. So in our Mishnah, that means he must keep it for the 12 months if there is no mum in it. Israel doesn't have the right to force the Kohen to take it if it doesn't have a mum in it. He's chayav. Rashai doesn't mean optional. And he brings evidence from a Mishnah in Arachin that the word Rashai sometimes means chayav. You're obligated to keep it. And so you might explain the same thing over here. Rashai l'kaimo, shtayim v'shlosh shanim. The Israel is obligated to keep it for those 2 or 3 years. And you can see in the Balei HaTosafot, Perish Bakuntris, Bekasha, my Rashai l'kaimo, shtayim v'shlosh shanim. Al korchach yikaimenu. What do you mean he's Rashai? He must keep it. The Dochak l'faresh Rashai l'shon chayav. And Tosafot rejects basically what the Rabbeinu Gershom said, which is, don't tell me that Rashai here means chayav. He says, that's a real stretch to say something like that. And I don't know if that is what is meant here. So one way to explain it is that you're obligated to keep it for 2 or 3 years. Part of that could be because there is no Kohen to give it to. Or maybe even if there is a Kohen to give it to, the Kohen can refuse to take it. It's a gift. It's matnot kuna. The Kohen can demur and say that I'm not interested in taking it because there's no benefit for me to take it at this point in time. So that might be what it means over here, Rashai l'kaimo shtayim v'shlosh shanim, which means that you must keep it for the 2-3 years because you can't do anything. It's in the hands of Israel. You don't have any right to do anything with it at this point, and therefore you're chayav to keep it around. That would agree with what the Rabbeinu Gershom said before. The word Rashai here means chayav. It would also seem to be what Rashi is indicating over here, that it's in the hands of Israel. Then Tosfot gives another option. Ve'avi matzina lefarish. It could explain it over here. The nakat rashai the kaimo komar ain't zakuk lekonsoli kippa. You don't have to lock it up and have it die, because that is the rule with regards to kodeshim today. If you have something that was nikdash today, the problem is takala. Huge problems of takala could arise. Therefore, kodeshino tobi kippa, and we have the animal die so that it doesn't cause problems. Because otherwise it's going to be around forever, and it could create huge problems, and people benefit from it, people utilize it, people have no idea that it's Kodesh. So you might have thought that Bechor has the same din, which is that if it didn't get a mum within the 12 months, keeping it around is dangerous, is risky, is problematic, and therefore maybe Kuntzinoto Bekipa, that's what it means, Rashai. You are permitted to keep it around, means we don't force you to be Kone Soto Lekipa. So those will give that alternative as an explanation. But all of this is premised on the fact that the Braita is speaking about Israel. And that's the way Rashi reads it, that we're dealing with something in the hands of the Israel at this point. And Rabbeinu Gershom says something similar, that it's something in the hands of the Israel. The Tosafot in the end is somewhat circumspect about that and says, maybe the Braita is speaking about in the hands of the Kohen, which is that it's already been given to the Kohen. And then, what does it mean, Rashai, that he's permitted to keep it around? Near the Farish. Ashel ne'ureh leharoto lechacham. Shalon yizdaman lo chacham achar shenafo bomu. You can read the phrase very simply. Ashel ne'ureh leharoto lechacham. He didn't have a chance to show it to the chacham. It has a mum in it. And it's with the Kohen. Just he hasn't had a chance to show it to the chacham. Or, there is no chacham in his neighborhood to show it to. So do we then compel him to go somewhere far away and get a chacham to opine on it? Or do we say that he can wait? And that's what it means, Rashai l'kaimo shtayim v'shlosh shanim. There's no obligation on the Kohen to show it to the chacham right away. He can take his time, wait for the chacham to come, or wait till he has an opportunity to bring it to the chacham. That's the way the Balei HaTosafot would explain it. So first of all, you have Rashi saying that it's in the hands of the Israel. It's in the hands of Israel, you have to explain what Rashai l'kaimo shtayim v'shlosh shanim is. What's the chiddush over there? Rashi says, again, it's a case where there's no mum. And that's what seems to be compelling the situation here, that he must keep it with himself for 2 or 3 years. So either you have to explain Rashai means Chayav, that he's obligated to give it, or Chayav because the Kohen's not going to accept it, or like the Baal HaTosfot would say, Rashai is, as opposed to Kontzino Tobi Kippah, he's allowed to keep it, he doesn't have to put it to death, we don't worry about Takala. On the other hand, the Baal HaTosfot would say, we're speaking about the Kohen, and the Kohen has a right to keep it around and not show it to the Chacham, even after it's got an Eimum in it. Okay. Umishinire laroto lo Chacham, if it already, according to Rashi now, has a mum in it, or according to the Baal HaTosfot, now he has a chacham to show it to. Nola no mum betok shnato. If it happened in its first year, Rashai lekaimo kol shnei masar chodesh. He's allowed to keep it for the full 12 months. Meaning that then he gets the waiver for the 12 months. Achar shnato, in Rashai lekaimo afilu yom echad. After his years elapsed, he can't keep it even for a single day. Afilu sha'achat. Or even one moment. Aval. Mipnei Hashavat Aveda, the Baalim, because of Hashavat Aveda to the Baalim, Amru, Rashay the Kaimo, Shloshim Yom. You're allowed to keep it for 30 days. So the truth is that the Breita is no more clear than the Mishnah was. The Gemara, for some reason, believes that this Breita sheds light on the Mishnah. Rashi claims that you can conclude from here, Alma, Lamed Yom, the Gemara, Nolod Mum, Tok Shnato, Kamak. By the mere fact that it says, Achar Shnato, Enu Rashay the Kaimo, sounds like the mum already happened, toch shnato. And therefore, just like in the break that's toch shnato, so too in our Mishnah. And the Rashash goes in the opposite direction because of the fact that it's talking about Hashabbat Aveda over here, which seems to be a totally independent scenario with regards to the 30 days, not connected to that which was said before in the break. And Rashi explains that now. Says, Shema, in Biyad Yisrael Havi Hai Bechor, maybe the Yisrael's holding out to this Bechor, and he can't find a Kohen to give it to. And if he shechs it right now, the basar is going to rot. There's no refrigeration. There's nothing to do with it. And he's trying to keep it for the Kohen. So they said you can keep it for an extra 30 days if you don't find a Kohen. So what the window of time for the Hashavat Aveda, according to this, is that the Israel is protecting the Kohen's interests or rights inside of the Behemah. According to Rashi, again, who says that the whole thing speaks about Israel that's holding on to a Bechor. And now at this point, the Bechor already has a mum in it. Now that it has a mum in it, you have the 12-month period that you could have kept. Now we tell you that after that period in time, we give you an additional 30 days of Hashavat Aveda, which is we give you another 30 days to find a Kohen to give it to. We first of all tell you, wait and see if you can find the Kohen. If you can't find the Kohen, we tell you to shecht it, salt it, preserve it, until you do find a Kohen. So the whole waiting period afterwards is to benefit the true owners of the Bechor, which are the Kohanim. So the Yisrael gets the window of the 12 months to deal with it. And if within that 12 months he can't deal with it because he doesn't have a Kohen to give it to, then he gets an additional window of 30 days. Not for himself, but to benefit the Kohanim. Because if he finds a Kohen then, he can give it to him and he can utilize it. If he shechts it and tries to wait around, it's going to go bad. After the 30 days elapse, we tell him shecht it, salt it, and then keep it. Basically refrigerate it, put it in the freezer for him. Because at that point, we're not going to force him to keep taking care of it. Rather, he can shecht it already at that point in time. So according to Rashi, the Bright is broken down into two scenarios. One scenario where there's no mum, and then the Yisrael's on the hook for years until it gets a mum in it. The second is scenario is it got a mum in it. And when it got a mum in it, you have the normal window of the 12 months, which is the 12 months of the life of that Bechor. Once those elapse, you also get an additional 30 days afterwards. And then according to Rashi, that would prove that our Mishnah is speaking about a case of 30 days appended onto the 12 months that you got. And that would be the explanation of our Mishnah. How you see that in the Lashon HaBraita is not clear. Whether that's because it says, Achar Shnato, in Roshad HaKaimo. For some reason, Rashi believes that that indicates something. We're going to see in a second that that's not so clear because the Gemara is going to ask a question. Rashi is going to say the Gemara just asked the same question again. Because the break is as unclear as the Mishnah. So look at the Rashash over here, actually concludes the exact opposite of Rashi. And he says that from this break, though, it's clear that you get 12 months and that's it. And then the Hashavat HaVeda is a reference to a mum that happens after the Shana has already elapsed. So he reads it just the opposite as a proof in just the opposite direction. The Baal HaTosafot over here, once again, say it's speaking about a Kohen who has it already. According to him, a Kohen has it already. Mishinlo nirela chacham means he hasn't found a chacham to show him the mum. Mishinirela chacham, once he's shown the chacham the mum, then we compel him to shech the animal and utilize it and not keep it around. how long does he have to do that? So if it's within the first year of the life, he's got the 12 months. And then he gets the bonus of 30 days afterwards because of a Shabbat Aveda. What does that mean? He doesn't always need meat. He didn't need the meat right away. So we give him an additional 30-day window to say, if you don't need the meat now, figure out in the next 30 days when you need it and shecht it over that period of the next 30 days. So that's Tosafot's explanation of the Braita. Ve'adayin tibayali. So according to Rashi, this is basically just reopening the question again, which is saying, thank you, I see the Braita. Rashi says we concluded that it means 30 days appended to the 12 months, but I could still ask. So, does the 30 days mean only when it has a mum after the 12 months have elapsed? Or does it mean when the mum happened before the 12 months elapsed? Or in essence, according to Rashi, it's the exact same question again. The Braita was no more conclusive than the Mishnah. Now, the difficulty with Rashi's reading is then, what was the Gemara thinking when it brought the Braita? What conclusion did it think it brought? So, he reopens the question. If you look in their Beinu Gershom, he sees the question as being something different. He says, another mum betok shnato. If it gets a mum within the year, do we say that when it gets a mum within the year, him you call the kaimo ko shnato, v'shuv lamed, alma denotim lo lamed achar mumo, v'lo lamed achar shnato. So meaning that the question is, when does that 30-day start? Does it kick in from the elapsement of the 12 months? Or does the 30 days kick in from the time the mum was manifest in the animal? Now, they could be running simultaneously, which means that if you got a mum anywhere before the last 30 days of the year, then the 30 days in the year are going to run simultaneously. It'll have no impact at all. But if it happens in the last 30 days of the year, then you would actually get additional days after the year has elapsed. Or the nature of the question is, what's the driving force of the 30 days? Is the 30 days triggered by the elapsement of the 12 months? Or is it triggered by the manifestation of a mum? That's how the Rabbeinu Gershom sees the question over here, which means that it's a totally new question. It's not about, is the 30 days appended to the 12 months? Or is it a totally independent 30 days? We already concluded that it's the 30 days are appended to the 12 months. The only question is, what triggers the 30 days? Are the 30 days triggered by the elapsement of the 12 months? Or are they triggered by the mum in the animal? Kashma, nolad lo mum b'chamishasar yom b'toch shnato. You got a mum 15 days into its year. Mashlimim lo chamishasar yom achar shnato. Then you get another 15 days at the end of the year. Shma mina. Now we got a conclusion. What the conclusion is depends on what you read in the Braita. Here Rashi and the Rabbeinu Gershom similarly reads it the same way. Rashi says, if after the years elapse, it gets a mum. O karov l'siyum shnato, or right at the end of a year, yavinan le'shloshim yom mishnolad mum. Then you get 30 days from the manifestation of the mum. Which means, according to Rashi, the situation, the scenario is 15 days before the end of the year, he got a mum in it. So now, he gets the 15 days, which are running simultaneously with his year anyway, so those don't make a difference. But then he gets an additional 15 days afterwards, which to complete his 30 days. Now, according to Rashi, that answers both of our questions. First of all, the 30 days are appended to the 12 months. Number two is, it answers Rabbeinu Gershom's question, which is, when do the 30 days start running? They run from the time of the mum. They don't run from the time of the elapsement of the 12 months. That's one way to read it. There is an alternate way to read the Braita, which might even be the simpler way to read the Braita, which is 15 days into its year, it got a mum in the beginning. And then the Braita is saying that you get 15 days at the back end afterwards. Or in essence, what it's saying is, when do the 12 months start? Do they start from the birth of the animal? Or do they start from the manifestation of the mum? So the answer would be, it starts from the manifestation of the mum with a cap of 30 days. Which is that if the mum happens within the first 30 days of the year, then in the back end you're going to get extra time, 30 days in the back end. If it happens any time after that, then you're not going to get any more than the 12 months that elapsed, plus the 30 days at the end, and therefore you'll have a cap out at 13 months, being the maximum amount of time that you could get. So it's 12 months from the manifestation of the mum, with a maximum of 13 months. So you could read the Braita saying that, and then that would mean that it comes just the opposite conclusion. That it's 30 days after the 12 months, no matter what. It's just that you can take down from that if the mum happens very early on, then we don't give you more than 12 months from the mum. So if the mum happened in the first 30 days, then you get no more than 12 months from that point in time of the mum. If it happens after that point in time, you get 12 months from the time of the mum up to a maximum of 30 days after the 12 months from its birth. But it has to do with, in the beginning, how early on did you get the mum, that will cap out your ability to get in the back end. Again, according to Rashi, this is referencing to Israel, and how long he's obligated to keep it around to look for a Kohen, to provide it to a Kohen, once it has a mum in it. As for Tosafot, it's how long the Kohen has, once the Chacham is opined on it, how much time does he have in order to shecht it and use it for meat? What is the window of opportunity that he has? Messiah Rabbi Elazar, this helps, or this is supportive of Rabbi Elazar's contention. Get 30 days from the time that the mum happened. In the way that Rashi and the Rabbeinu Gershom explained it, that's exactly what Rabbi Elazar is saying over here. From the time you get the mum, that's when the count of the 30 days begins. And that means if it's anywhere in the last 30 days of the first year, then you're going to get those additional days afterwards because it starts to count from the time that you get the mum. According to the other way that we read it, means that you get from the time the mum is started, you get your 12 months up to 30 days afterwards. You can't get more than the total of 13 months. So again, that would also be driven by the mum, not by the 12-month period. Igadam, right? Some say, Amar Abelazim, Inayin de Bechor Shinolad Bo Mum Betok Shnato, Shnot Imlo Shlushim Yom Achar Shnato. How do you know if you have a mum in the middle of the year that you give him 30 days afterwards? Shinemar, Lefnei Hashem Lokecha Dochlenu Shana Bishana. That's the apostle that we discussed yesterday. Shana Shana. Ezuhein Yamim Achashuvim Shana. What are the minimum amount of days that is classified as a year? Habe Omer, Elu Shloshim Yom. Those are 30 days. Machloket in the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah as to whether Yom Echad Hashanah is Shana. Shloshim Yom Hashanah is Shana. But everybody agrees, once you reach a Chodesh, once you reach 30 days, everybody agrees 30 days is like a year. Says Nafkamino to Halacha today, especially with planting of trees for the issues of Orla, if you plant it 30 days before Rosh Hashanah, that counts as a full year of Orla, and then you start your second year after Rosh Hashanah. So that is 30 days within a year. So he's saying here, you have a Bechor that is Shana Bishana, means that it has 2 years. So how do you get 2 years for a Bechor? It gets the 12 months that you're entitled to, plus Bishana, another year. That another year is not a full year, it's 30 days, which is like a year. And therefore, Rabbi Elazar says, automatically you get 13 months. You get 12 months plus 30 days, irrespective of where the mum took place. Now Gemara says, Meitavei, can you really say that? The bright that we just brought seems to say not like that, which is, Nola the mum b'chamisha sayom b'toch shnato, mashlimino chamisha sayom achar shnato. If it happened either 15 days into his year, or in the last 15 days of his year, we spoke about the two different ways to read it, you get an additional 15 days at the end. Hashlema in, mihava lo. You get to make up those days, but you don't get a full 30 days automatically at the end. Tiyufta, the Rabbi Elazar, tiyufta. According to that lashon of Rabbi Elazar, the Braita's refutation of Rabbi Elazar's opinion, because the Braita clearly says that it's dependent on the mum, whereas Rabbi Elazar says it's independent of the mum. In the first scenario, we said that the Braita said it was taloi b'mum, and that's what Rabbi Elazar said as well, and that's why the Braita was supportive of Rabbi Elazar's contention. All right, ashochet et ha-bechor umar'eh et mumo. A person who shechted the bechor and then takes it to the Chacham to show him the mum. So he shechted it without showing the Chacham the mum, and now post the Shechita, he goes to show it to him. Rabbi Yehuda Matir, Rabbi Yehuda says that the Chacham looks at it now and says that it was a mum kabua, the Bechor is fine and the Kohen can eat it. Rabbi Meir Omer, Ho v'nishchat shelo api mumcheh, asur. Since you shechted it without permission, you didn't get an expert to look at it beforehand, you are therefore going to lose it now, and you're not going to get any benefit from it. It is asur to you. Mi she'enu mumcheh v'ruet ha-bechor. Someone who represents himself as an expert, but he isn't an expert, and he opines on a bechor, v'nishchat al-piv, and then the person shechts the animal based on his recommendation, harizei kaver, v'shalem be'beito. Then you bury it, and he's got to pay out of pocket. He caused the loss, and now it has to be buried because it was shechted without permission. And now that it was shechted without permission, nothing you can do with it. It has to be buried. It seems to be, at least at this latter half of the Mishnah, seems to be following the position of Rabbi Meir, because it's saying here that after the fact, you can't do anything about it. Is that you could show it to a Chacham after the fact and rectify it, then why did it have to be Yikaver? So this sounds like Rabbi Meir Shita. We'll see what the Gemara says. Amar Rabbi Bar Chana, Bedokin Shibayin Kuli Amalo Plige. Everybody agrees when it comes to Rashi over here translates Dokin Shibayin as Tila Kamo Hanotek Dok Shemayim. There's some sort of line or something in the eye, which is what we would today call a cataract. That type of mum is sufficient to shech the bechor on it. So that dokin shibayin is where everybody agrees that you can't look at it after the fact. Everybody agrees that it's asur. That changes with the death of the animal. There is a certain amount of cloudiness or distortion that happens to the eye of an animal after it is dead. And therefore, if you're looking for a cataract after the fact, you don't know if that happened beforehand or happened afterwards. And therefore, even Rabbi Huda would agree that it's asur in that situation. That's Rashi's explanation here. Back on Tetzayin Amud Aleph, Rashi gave two explanations for Dokin Shibayin, which makes it a little harder. Over there, he brought the explanation that he brought here, Dokin Tula. You're going to take a Dok Shemayim, exactly what he wrote here. But then Lishna Achrina, Dokin Sheishla Mumba Afapayim. He has some sort of injury or wound on the eyelid. And that's what the Dokin Shibayin is over here. And that's a little harder to explain in this situation. You don't see Rashi bringing that explanation over here. Because if it really is a physical mum in the eyelid, that shouldn't have changed with the death of the animal. Rashi over here says the stress of death causes some change in the eye, some physical change in the eye, which causes a certain amount of cloudiness or problems that might have been there before, either to be covered up or the other way around. Problems that weren't there before are now manifested there. So it could be a cataract or could it be even some other eye ailments that are only really can be checked before the death of the animal. So over there, even Rabbi Yehuda agrees that at that point you can't check and you can't be matir the bechor. Lo nechlok lo elam mumim shibagul. Their machloket is about physical mumim in the body of the animal, which should not change with the death of the animal. If the animal is missing a limb, it has a cut, its ear is missing, none of that changes with the death of the animal. That's something that if you look afterwards and there's no ear, there was no ear beforehand. It didn't fall off just because he shechted the animal. The Rabbi Meir Savar, Gazrinin Mumim Shibaguf Atu Dokin Shibayin. Rabbi Meir says, Gzeira, because of Dokin Shibayin, therefore we now go there by all other items that there's no permitting them after the fact. Rabbi Yehuda Savar, Lo Gazrinin Mumim Shibaguf Atu Dokin Shibayin. You're right, Dokin Shibayin, you can't be matir. Other things you can be matir. Bifurcate the din between things that do change and don't change. Things that don't change, you can check them after the fact, bidi avad. Tanya nami ochi, we have a brayta that supports this contention. Hashochet et bechor. Someone checks the bechor, umar e et mumav. And then he shows the mumim afterwards to the chacham. Rabbi Yehuda omer, bedokin shabayin asur. When it comes to dokin shabayin, then you can't check it after the fact, mipnei she'em mishtamnin, because they change. Mumim shebeguf, mutar, mipnei she'em mishtamnin. And the mumim shebeguf, you can't check after the fact, because they don't change. It's exactly what we just said. Rabbi Yehuda's position is Rabbi Meir Omer Echadzev Echadzev Asur. Both of them are Surim Mipnei Shein Mishtanim because they change. Where it says, what do you mean Mipnei Shein Mishtanim? Mishtei Sheshanim Sankadatcha Mumish Beguf Mi Mishtanim. How could you say that it's because they change? Mumish Beguf don't change. There's no way that an ear missing changed after the fact. It was missing before. It was missing afterwards. It's not something that changes. Eli Mipnei Ham Mishtanim. You have to read it because of those things that change. Therefore, he goes there by things that don't change, that you're not allowed to check them after the fact. Amar Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak Matnitan Nami Deka. Our Mishnah is Meduyeket. That's what you noted in our Mishnah already. That Rabbi Meir Omer Hov in Ishchat Shalo Api Mumche Asur. The reason that Rabbi Meir gives for the fact that it is Asur is because it wasn't checked by a Mumche beforehand. If the real reason was that it's because they change after the fact, then Rabbi Meir should have said, the reason you can't check afterwards is Mipnei Shehei Mishtanin. Because they checked. That's not what he says. He says the reason is because he didn't check with the chacham. So it makes it clear that the reason that it's problematic afterwards is not because of the change, but because of you didn't get the opining of the chacham. Shmamina, knoso kokonis Rabbi Meir. You can see here that Rabbi Meir is imposing a penalty on the individual. Shmamina. That is the conclusion over here. Now, this is an interesting change in the Gemara. The Gemara said before that it was a gezeira atu, and then also here the Gemara says it's a knas. It is a fine that is imposed. So what happened? Is it a gzeira or is it a fine? So there is the Tosafot Chitzoniot over here suggests that that's the gzeira is the knas, meaning that because of the knas, therefore we instituted a gzeira, meaning that they go hand in hand. Does it really matter if it's a gzera or knas? The answer is yes. There's a very large Tosafot in the Gemara in Bava Metzia on Daf Ayin Bet Amud Aleph, where it speaks about a machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim with regards to a shtar. And a document that has ribit, interest charged in it. Someone lent money to an individual and charged them interest. And now they're coming to make a claim with the shtar. It's clear that we're not going to enforce the shtar with regards to the interest because that's illegal. Question is, what about the principal amount? Can he collect it? So over there, the Chachamim say he can collect the principal with the shtar, but with regards to the interest, he can't. Rabbi Meir says that we are konesim. Because he charged interest, we're not going to even allow him to claim the principal amount with a shtar. It'll become a milvel peh, and he will have to collect it without the rights of a shtar. Over there, Tosafot deals with what exactly is the status of the shtar, both according to the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir. But the important point in that Tosafot is, where Tosafot brings up the memory of Shmuel, who says that halacha ke Rabbi Meir b'gzeirotav. Halacha is always like Rabbi Meir when it's a gzeira. Now, the halacha generally is, when you have a machloka Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Meir, halacha ke Rabbi Yehuda. That's one of the principles of Psach. Rabbi Yehuda trumps Rabbi Meir. So over here you have a machloka Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir, but it's a gzeira. So which principle of Psach is going to govern over here? Is it the principle of Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir, halacha Rabbi Yehuda? Or is it the principle of halacha ke Rabbi Meir, b'gzeirotav? Tosafot over here, and in that Gemara Bava Metzia says, the halacha is not like Rabbi Meir, because when we say halacha ke Rabbi Meir, b'gzeirotav, we mean b'gzeirotav, v'lo b'knasotav. It's only when it's a gzeira, not when it's a knas. And both that Gemara in Bava Metzia, the penalty is exactly that. It's punitive. It's a penalty because you tried to charge interest. We're going to take away your rights to the principal as well. And simply over here, because you shechted it without checking, even though technically you can check it after the fact, we're going to penalize you for not doing it in the right way, and you're going to lose the animal, even though technically we can check it now. That's a knas. That's punitive. It's not just a gzeira. And because of that, Tosafot says the halacha is not like Rabbi Meir over here, because halacha the Rabbi Meir b'gzerotav velo b'knasotav. So it's significant that the Gemara changed the lashon over here to knas, even though it started out speaking about a gzeira. So then you have to explain again, why did it change, or what is the nature of that change over here? And it could be that the gzeira was the knas, meaning that the knas precipitated the necessity for such a gzeira, but that means inherently it is a knas and not a gzeira. When it comes to Dokin Shiba'ayin, is it true that it always changes? And that's what it means, that because of those things that change, because Dokin Shiba'ayin always change, therefore he's Kones in the other case. Or is the problem by Dokin Shiba'ayin that sometimes it changes, sometimes it's not? It doesn't change. The question basically is, we know by Mumim Shibaguf they don't change. By Mumim Shibayin, we know they do change. What is the probability of change with regards to Dokin Shibayin? Is it an absolute? I mean, they definitely change, and therefore, it's always problematic? Or is it, sometimes they change, sometimes they don't change? But my Nafkamina, why does it matter? We're not going to let you paskin based on that, because there's a probability or a chance that it changed. So why should it matter whether it does or does not change, or it's 100% changes? In neither case are we going to let you be Matir the Bechor. It says, Lachshushe Sadeh. The reason it makes a difference is when you're trying to perjure Edim. Iamart kulu mishtane. Then if we say that all Dokin Shiba'ayin change, shakreininu, then they are liars. If they come and testify and say that the Dokin Shiba'ayin now looks exactly like the way it did before it was shechted, so then based on their testimony, we would say that the Mum Kavua existed beforehand, just like it existed now. If they come along and say that, and 100% of the times it changes, then you could say they're lying. Because there's no way it looks the same afterwards like it looked before. If there's sometimes where it changes, sometimes it doesn't change, then we can rely on them in that instance, because now we have testimony to tell us that whatever is now was exactly like it was before. And those witnesses can be believed, because there are possibilities, there are probabilities that it didn't change. And therefore they would be believed. Now obviously this is all according to Rabbi Yehuda, who says that after the fact you can still check it. Because if it's according to Rabbi Meir, it doesn't matter what they deem say, because once it's done, and what's done is done, we can't penalize you, and you're not allowed to get any heter with regards to this bechor. My, what's the din, or what's the situation? Tashma, Damar Rabbi Barchana, exactly, Rabbi Yoshia, Diminusha. Rabbi Barchana says, Rabbi Yoshia, Diminusha told me, Bo Berechka, Bedokin Shein Mishtanim. Come here and I'm going to show you a situation in which the Dokin Shemayin change with the death of the animal or with the killing of the animal. The Carmelite Bo Bereka, when he says, come and see, he's telling, look, I have one. I have a case for you to look at. Means that sometimes it does change, sometimes it doesn't change. If it changes every time, then why does he have to show him? You could just look at any animal before and afterwards and you'll see that it changed. Someone who's not an expert and opines on the Bechor, that's what I mentioned. It sounds like that part of the Mishnah is like Rabbi Meir, because after the fact, we don't allow you to check it at all. Dilma, the Dokin Shabayin, the Divrei Akol. Maybe it's speaking about a case of Dokin Shabayin, where you can't check it after the fact, and even Rabbi Huda would agree here, that you kaver, you have to bury it, because there's no option after the fact to check it. Tana, Kishahu Mishalim, when he has to pay here, meaning this person who opined on it, and was not an expert, or was not qualified to do such, and then they shefted it based on that, and now we lose the whole animal, how much does he have to compensate? The non-expert who opined, and based on his suggestion, we shefted the animal, now it has to be buried because you can't check it after the fact. He caused you a loss. How much do we charge him for causing that loss? Mishalem revia l'daka. He pays a quarter of the value for a smaller animal. Umechsa l'gaso, and he pays half the value for a larger animal. My time, huh? What's the reason? Amar Papa, zehef seid merubeh, zehef seid muat. One of them is a large loss. One of them is a small loss. My says, if that's the case, lefum pseida lishalim, then just pay based on the loss. If it has to do with how big or small the loss is, why is it by the daka you're only getting a quarter, by the gatsa you're getting half? If it has to do with the fact that the larger animal is a bigger loss, we're dealing with a percentage here. It should be 50% of the daka, 50% of the gatsa, and the 50% of the gatsa will be more because it's a larger loss. Why are you changing the percentage? Why are you changing the percentage of its payment if it all has to do with the amount of the loss? So I'm Rabbeinu Bar Noach, Mishmei de Rav Acha Bar Ika, Mishum Gzeirat, Gadlei Behema Daka Naguba. It has to do with this Gzeira with regards to Megadlei Behema Daka. So first of all, we have to take a step back and understand, why is this individual only paying a quarter or a half over here? So Rashi explains it as it's a case of Mamona Mutalba Safek. It's money that is uncertain. And we have a principle which it seems that Rashi is subscribing to, the principle of Sumchus, which is Mamona to Mutalba Safek Chokim. Whenever you have mamon that's left in a safek, you split it. The chachamim disagree with that and say, "Amotzi mechaveiro alav harayah." So there are rishonim who believe that we do pasim like sumkos, and that mamon mutaba safek is chokim because there are a number of mishnayot and gemarot in Shas that seem to say that, including what Rashi says this gemara over here that mamon mutaba safek chokim. So many people believe we pasim like sumkos, and there are instances where we don't. The chachamim's position is "Amotzi mechaveiro alav harayah." Whoever wants to change the status quo, the burden of proof is on them. Tosafot argues on that view and says that we never pass on like sumkos, and all those cases where it's mamon mutaba safek chokim, there's a reason why that is the case, not because of sumkos. And Tosafot does the same thing over here. Rashi claims that there's a safek over here. The safek is, had you not shechted this animal, had you shown it to a chacham, a real chacham, he may never have been matir this animal with this mum. That's number one. And if he wasn't matirit, you may never have gotten another mum in it. You may never have gotten the benefit of eating this animal. It might have gone on for its whole life, died, without it ever getting a mum. Plus, in the meantime, you have expenditures that are associated with the animal. So in this instance, the reason you're not paying for the whole animal is because there's a safek. A safek whether you really caused him a loss, because now he has to bury it, versus had he kept it, that he would have been able to eat it. Or, maybe even if he didn't bury it here, based on your suggestion, the animal would never have gotten a mum or didn't have a mum kavua, and you would never have been able to eat it anyway. So in that case, you didn't cause him a loss. Since it's a 50-50 shot, whether you caused him a loss or didn't cause him a loss, therefore, it's mamon mutaba safek chokim, 50-50. Then the Gemara asks, well, then why is it 50-50 by the Behema Gasa and not the Behema Daka? That's because the loss is bigger over there. Why is the loss bigger over there? It's all have to do with the size of the loss. They just make it a fixed percentage for both of them. Gemara's answer is gzeirah. We'll talk about that in a second. Tosafot disagrees with Rashi and says that we do not subscribe to this idea that mamona mutaba safek is chokim. Ela takanat chachamim ba'almo. It's a takanat chachamim. Ba'af agav da'ari ba'almom, afil yadua shi'tirenu mumche yado. Even if we knew that a mumche would have agreed and said that this is rightfully shefted over here,
I mean, after the fact, you looked at it, and it would have been fine. Mikom makom choshiv le'safek ketzat. There's always a safek. Shemelo maskik le mumche. Maybe he wouldn't find a mumche. Meaning he doesn't have a chacham around that could have looked at it. And maybe he wouldn't have had a mum. Meaning that there are a number of sfeikot here, and we make it a low plug to takanat chachamim, that this is the way that we split the loss over here. Tosfot does bring another possibility that that is the real value of the animal, where he shows in other places in Shas that the Gemara says truma, in contrast to chulin, is about 50% the value of the chulin. And maybe he would say the same thing here about a bechor versus a regular animal. Although there is a big difference because truma can only be eaten by kohanim, bitaharam, whereas chulin can be eaten by anyone and eaten if they're tamei. By bechor, you don't have any of those restrictions. It can be eaten by anyone. It can even be eaten by tuma. There's some small restrictions regarding it. So to say that it would have the same differential of value that truma has vis-a-vis chulin seems not to be so logical. But Tosfot at least proposes that maybe that's where the 50% came from in this situation. So Rashi claims that it's mi'ikar adin, that you split it because it's mamono mutaba safek. Tosfot says, takanat chachamim, that says, listen, there are a number of sfekot over here. It really should be motzi mechaver olav araya, but because you did cause a loss over here, but there is some uncertainty in it, we're going to come up with a way to split it and make it look good, and that is 50-50. That's the way we determine. Even though you know for sure it was a full loss over here, it would have been shechted by a mumche. A mumche would have said it's a mumche bua. Doesn't matter. Takanat chachamim. According to Rashi, if you have a mumche that says it was a fine mum and you could have shechted on it, then he caused him a full loss, and maybe you should have to pay the whole amount. According to Tosafot, there's no such thing. It's a takanat chachamim. It's a flat rate of 50-50. According to Rashi, it seems to be meikar din. You have to look at the din in each situation, look at the probabilities, and figure out what the safek was. Then the Gemara says, well then, why do you do 50% by the kasa and 25% by the daka? The Gemara says, gzeira migadli behema daka naguba. Rashi brings two possible explanations of that. One is, yishum torach migadli behema daka. There's a lot of work in raising behema dakot. Even though it seems counterintuitive, because the bigger animals eat more. Nevertheless, it seems like the bigger animals graze and are self-sufficient in many ways. The smaller animals need a lot more help from you and need a lot more work from you. And therefore, there's more expenditure, more effort that has to be put into bringing up a behema daka. And therefore, the situation where you caused him to lose the animal, you also caused him in the great savings. Because now the kohen doesn't have to take care of the animal anymore. So by behema kasa, that's a certain amount of savings. By behema daka, it's even more savings because the amount or the investment that you have to make in a behema daka is larger than a behema kasa. That's one reasoning that Rashi says. That's the gzeira. You only pay 25% by the behema daka because behema daka, had you kept it around, would have cost you more to keep it around. Behema kasa, 50% because it costs you less to keep it around. The second one that Rashi brings is based on the Gemara and Baba Kama that says you're not allowed to raise behema dakot in Eretz Yisrael. There is a restriction to save the yishuv anywhere that it's inhabited. Places where people live, you're not allowed to graze behema dakot because they are destructive in nature. The truth is that it's really goats that are the worst, not sheep. But goats eat anything green, anything that's alive. If you leave goats to graze in an area, there'll be nothing alive after they finish there because they'll eat away, they'll chew away the bark of the tree, they'll kill all the trees, they'll kill anything that is alive in that area, which is destructive to the yishuv. They took it out from the time of Yehoshua ben Nun not to raise behema dakot in the yishuv. Because of that gezerah, the chachamim were konsimoto, that you only get a quarter. Because the kohen is keeping around his behema daka, even though he doesn't really have a choice in the matter, since he's keeping around his behema daka, that gezerah causes us to say, we're going to pay you less for this, because we don't want you keeping around behema daka. So Rashi splits it into two reasons. One possibility is it just takes more effort and undertaking to bring up behema daka, so we're going to give you less because he saved you money. Or the other one is that because you're not supposed to be bringing up behema daka, therefore, we're only going to pay you a smaller amount. Tosafot takes Rashi's two reasons and combines them and says that's the whole point. The reason it's harder to bring up a behema daka is because of the gzeirah. The gzeirah is that you're not allowed to bring them up in the inhabited areas, which means that the only way you can take care of a behema daka is to take it out into the forest, into the uninhabited areas. That's more work, more effort on your behalf. So why is it that we're going to pay you more? Because he saved you money. The trouble of bringing up a behema daka is that you can't just keep it locally. You have to take it out into the graze in the fields outside of the inhabited areas. That's going to cost you more. It's more effort, more undertaking. Because of that, we're only going to pay you a compensation of a quarter, not a half, because he saved you all that money, saved you all that effort. And so Tosafot takes the two reasons and combines them together. All right, next Mishnah. Danet Adin. Given the context of the Mishnah and the Mishnah before and the Mishnah afterwards, we're talking about a yachid, an individual who adjudicated a case. Dozovo points out that there are other places in Shas where Danet Adin doesn't always refer to an individual, can refer to more than one person. But Dozovo says over here in the context of Mishnayot, it's clear it's an individual who's adjudicating by himself. And when he did that, Zikat HaChayav, he made a mistake. And he exonerated someone that was culpable, B'chayevet HaZakai, or he obligated someone who was, otherwise, should have been acquitted, or should have been exonerated. Timei et HaTahor, he made something that was Tor Tamei, B'tiher et HaTamei, or he said something that was Tamei is Tor. Masha Sa Asui, whatever is done, is done. V'shalim mi beito, he has to pay out of pocket. V'imaya mumcha the beitin, if he was in a court-appointed judge, patur v'mishalim, he is then exempt from payment because he gets judicial immunity. If you are a mumcha the beitin, you're given a certain amount of indemnification, judicial immunity, that you don't have to pay when you make a mistake in this situation. So that implies that whoever was giving the judgment in the first case or adjudicating the case in the first part of the Mishnah is not a mumcha the beitin. He could be a mumcha, but he's not a mumcha the beitin. So since he's not an appointed judge, the fact that he adjudicated the case means that he's taking upon himself the risk of making a mistake. If he makes a mistake, he's got to pay out of pocket for that mistake. The Gemara says, Leimatznan stamak Rabbi Meir. Let us say our Mishnah is following the position of Rabbi Meir, the Dain Dine de Garmi. Because he says that when it comes to Garmi, we will enforce the culpability of an individual when it comes to garmi. This is a big sugya in the Gemara Baba Kama, which we discussed in the Gemara Baba Kama, which is what's the difference between garmi and grama. We know that grama in the zikin is patur. When you have an indirect cause, you are patur with regards to the zikin. So grama would be indirect causation, nezek would be direct causation. Garmi sits somewhere in between those two. According to the Baalei HaTosafot, it's simply a knas of the chachamim. In these types of situations, the chachamim felt that we didn't impose a fine on individuals, then people would do this or act in this way, which would be inappropriate because they know they have no culpability. So therefore, we're kones them. Most other Rishonim believe that it's mi'ikar adin, and that is that there is a fundamental difference between groma and garmi. The question of what that difference is subject to a machloket in the Rishonim. Many focus on time delay. Groma, or an indirect cause, is when there's some sort of time delay between your action and then the reaction or the result of your action. Versus garmi, where there is a direct correlation between, even though it's indirect, your action and the outcome of your action, there isn't a time delay. That's one way to explain the difference between grama and garmi. The other one has to do with whether your action is directly affecting the object of your action. Meaning that indirect grama is where you take an action, and then that has an indirect cause and affects another item. Whereas garmi is your action is directly affecting the item upon which the action was taken. That's another way to distinguish between grama and garmi. So Rabbi Meir is of the opinion there in the Gemara Baba Kama that we do adjudicate cases of garmi. This is your classic case of garmi. Here the judge spoke, and his speaking now causes losses for individuals. So first of all, whatever he said directly affected the item. There is no time delay. From the time he gives up psak halacha, then he's caused the problem where he's made the mistake and the loss is caused. So this is a classic case of garmi in the situation where he wrongly told one person that you are chayab, the other one that you are patur. Then there is someone who's a beneficiary and there's someone who lost out over here. So why don't we just go say, reverse the psak? The problem is that you can't reverse the psak because the individual who he goes to and says, listen, I was wrong in the first place. Now I'm changing that. He'll say, how do I know that this decision is better than that decision? I'm not going to listen to you. You already gave a decision. I thought that was the right decision. And therefore, he's not going to disgorge whatever you gave to him. The guy who lost the money is out the money still. So that's why the judge has to pay over here, because he can't compel the other individual to give the money back. The mumche, who's not a mumche, the beitin, he has to now pay out of pocket, because he can't compel the person that he gave the money to wrongly to give it up, because the guy says, I thought what you said first was right. Why am I going to believe you now when you changed your mind? For the other guy, where he owes the money to, he's got to make compensation for it. That's why he's out of pocket in this situation. The Gemara in Sanhedrin deals with this much more deeply, because there are situations where you're allowed to change your mind and where you're not allowed to change your mind. There the Amoraim discuss ukimtot as to when you are and are not allowed to change your mind. So it sounds like from this Mishnah that we're paskin like Rabbi Meir, that we're done in dinei de garmi, because we're obligating the party here even though it wasn't nezek yashir, it was indirect nezek, but it was garmi, not grama, because either it was no time delay or because it was affecting the object itself. So Amar Yilay Amarav Kagon Shenasa Minatam Bayad. So the Gemara in Baba Kama, when it discusses it, in Sanhedrin when it discusses it, they bring the same answer, which is, this is a situation in which he got involved physically with the sock that he gave. The answer of Rabbi Eloy is that we're not dealing in Garmi, we're dealing in direct Nezek over here, because he's no same no tame biyad. When it says, Bishlama Chiye Mitzazakai, if he obligated the person who was otherwise should have been exonerated over here, Kagon Shinasav Natan Biyad. So then you can explain that he took the money from the one who was Zakai, and he gave it to the other party. El Zikeya Techayav, when he then exonerates someone should have paid, Hey Chidami, where's the no saving no ten biyad? So in a situation where he mistakenly says that you owe money to someone else, and then he takes the money from you and he hands it to the other guy, that's no saving no ten biyad. But in a situation when he says to the guy who really owes money, you don't owe money, there's nothing changing hands over here. You're just keeping the status quo. So where's the no saving no ten biyad? It says, Idar Malay Patur Ata, if he says you're Patur, that you're exempt now, Halo no saving no ten biyad, he didn't actively get involved. Then it is garmi and not direct nezek. I can explain that when you take money from one and give it to the other incorrectly. But when you exempt someone from having to make payment, then where is there no saving at temiyad? It's a case where the lender had collateral from the borrower. And now the judge says to the borrower, you're exempt. You don't have to pay anymore. So he hasn't done anything actively, but now he takes the mashkon that was left with the lender and hands it back to the borrower. So then he caused them direct losses by doing such. Timei tator. So in a case where he made that which was tor tamei, da'aga bahu b'sheretz. He went ahead and he took a sheretz and he put it on it. He says, I think this is tamei, and I'm so certain it's tamei, I want to show you, I'm going to put a sheretz on it to make sure you know that it's tamei and there's no safek about it. So he actively made it tamei now with that mistaken sock. And in the case where this was stuff that was tamei, he then takes it and dumps that whole barrel into the rest of his stuff. So now he causes it a huge losses because he directly dumped it and then it now makes everything that's there tamei. So he caused direct losses. Because of that, he's culpable. So it doesn't have to be dini de garmi. It could be regular nezek, and that's why he's on the hook over here. Tosfot does point out that it's strange that both the Gemara here and the Gemara in Baba Kama never brings the previous Mishnah as an example that is supportive of Rabbi Meir. And that is because the Mishnah at the bottom of the previous Amud says that Mishenu Mumche, someone who's not a certified expert in this area, Broeta Bechor, and he opines on a Bechor, Menishchad Al Piv, and it was shechted based on his statement, his psak, Harizei Yikaver Mishalei Mi Beito. So you see from that even Al Piv, which is a din of Garmi, we still say you're Chayav. That Mishnah is heavily supportive of Rabbi Meir's position. And the Baal Tosafot are bothered by the fact that neither the Gemara here nor the Gemara in Baba Kama brings that as supportive of Rabbi Meir's position. It could be that because that latter part of the Mishnah is the Shita at Rabbi Meir, even though our Gemara gave an answer that it could be Rabbi Yehuda, but if you believe that that is Shita at Rabbi Meir, then it's really Rabbi Meir lish Shita to, and maybe it doesn't prove anything. Even though it is a Stam Mishnah, it's clear that it's according to Rabbi Meir. And if it's according to Rabbi Meir, then you're just proving that Rabbi Meir is consistent in his position, not necessarily proving that the Stam Mishnah holds, like Rabbi Meir, that we're dying dine de garmi. Umasei bipara. Here's a situation where we had a para, shenitlaha aim shelah, whose womb was removed. Vechila Rabbi Tarfon the klavim. And Rabbi Tarfon then paskin that it was a treifa, and said you can feed it to the dogs, and that's what the owner did. He chopped it up and gave it to the dogs because it was a treifa. The incident mentioned to the Chachamim in Yavne, and they said it's not a treifa. Shamar Todos HaRofe, because Todos the Rofe, who appears a number of times in Shas as an individual who lived in Rome but had strong connections with the Chachamim and might even have been a Chacham himself. It's not clear because in the Gemara Pesachim it sounds like he didn't listen to the Chachamim, so it's not clear whether there were two different people called Todos, or whether this Tosa Rofe was a Chacham, and he sometimes followed the Shita of the Chachamim, sometimes didn't. But he says, Ein para v'chazira yotza melakzandria shel Mitzrayim, no cow or pig leaves Mitzrayim, shein chotchim eim shela, until they cut out the womb of that animal, b'shvil shelo teleid, so that their technology would be kept. They wanted to protect their trade secrets, which is that they had great pigs and great cows in Mitzrayim, and they didn't want anybody else to be able to breed them. So that means if they sold them for out-of-the-country use, they automatically cut out the womb so that nobody could then reproduce whatever they had there. But by the mere fact that they did that shows you that that doesn't make it into a treifa. Because if it made it to a treifa, nobody would buy from them and then take it home, because you would ruin the animal. It would die afterwards. You'd weaken the animal. The fact that they did this and people still bought the animals from them shows you that it doesn't have the effect of being a treifa when you cut out the womb. Amar Rabbi Tarfon, so Rabbi Tarfon says about himself, you just lost your donkey, Rabbi Tarfon, because now you have to compensate for the mistaken psak over here. You just caused a loss to this individual. When you paskin it was a treifa, he fed it to the dogs, he lost out a lot of money there. Now you have to compensate him, you're going to lose your donkey compensating him. Amar lo, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Tarfon, atah mumcha de beitin, you're an expert. You were appointed as a judge. And anybody who's an expert judge does not have to pay. So where it says, V'tipoklei t'tab d'var mishnah, why don't you learn over here that he made a mistake with regards to a mishnah? Rashi claims the mishnah is a mishnah in Chulin that says that if you take out the womb, it's not considered to be a treifa. Now that's interesting only because Rabbi Tarfon is much older than Rabbi. Rabbi, the Mesader HaMishnah, who put all these Mishnayot together, was much younger than Rabbi Tarfon. So then, what does it mean that he knew that Mishnah in Chulin? That goes to the explanation of what Rabbi did. Rabbi didn't write the Mishnayot. Rabbi didn't create the Mishnayot. He was the Mesader HaMishnayot. The Mishnayot existed. He just organized them and he ordered them. So that Mishnah that was in Chulin, Rabbi Tarfon should have been familiar with it. And it's a Tar B'Dvar Mishnah. The Gemara in Sanhedrin discusses what that means, Tar B'Dvar Mishnah. But it's anything where there's a clear halacha. It's anything where everybody paskins one way. It's something where the outcome should have been obvious. That means it doesn't really have to be a Mishnah. A Mishnah is an example of where if it's explicit in the Mishnah, then you should have known it because it's obvious. That's true about a Mishnah. It's true about a Moraim as well. If you have a Machoket Amoraim and it's clear which way you have to paskin, the Gemara either gives a Psak Halacha or the Klali of Psak would dictate you have to paskin this way in this situation, then in that case, it's also targeted by Mishnah. It's something that's so obvious that you should have known it, and therefore we don't consider it as a retraction when you back out of the case, because it's something that's black and white, not open to interpretation, and since it's not open to interpretation, first of all, it doesn't degrade the standing of the Beit Din, because the fact is that everybody knows that that's wrong, and therefore you can back out of it. And number two is, there's a certain amount of culpability put on the question over here. The questioner should have known this. You come to Beit Din to ask questions where you need adjudication. You don't come to the Beit Din to ask questions when it's black and white and Shulchan Aruch. So those aren't the types of cases that you should come to Beit Din for. So in those cases where you made Talmud of our Mishnah, then you can back out of it, you can reverse the case. Now over here, as Rashi points out, you can't reverse the case. The guy already cut up the animal and fed it to the dog, so there's no reversing the case. So Rashi says, because he had the right to reverse it, therefore the guy who shechted his animal and fed it to the dogs caused his own loss. Rabbi Tarfon is exempt over here because he could have reversed it. Had the guy not cut it up yet, he could have just told him it's fine. The fact that he cut it up means that he wasn't really relying on Rabbi Tarfon because Rabbi Tarfon's psak was incorrect. And he should have known it's incorrect because it's targeted by Mishnah. And so the guy who cut it up caused his own loss. It's a very interesting logic that's being dictated over here. The Gemara is asking, why isn't he just exempt because it's targeted by Mishnah and he could have backed out of it? Gemara says, Chadavod Kamar. It's this and that. In that there are two reasons why you have judicial immunity over here. Chada, the Tarbet of our Mishnah, Chozer. Number one is, this was such an obvious mistake that there's no reason that you couldn't have reversed your position. And since you could have reversed your position, you're now culpable for the losses over here. Vo'od, inami b'shikul adat, ta'ita, had it been that you made a mistake in something that requires discernment, then even so, mumcha the Beit Din ata, you are an expert judge. And if you're an expert judge, you get judicial immunity, and therefore you'd be exempt. Shikul Hadat, according to Rashi, is a case where the Gemara doesn't come to a conclusive psak halacha with regards to a machloket, and there is room for interpretation, though the majority of the sugyot of Gemara seem to follow one of the two opinions, and therefore it heavily favors one of the two opinions. But there is a possibility or a probability that a person could make a mistake or make a judgment mistake with regards to this. Or he takes a position that is against what the majority of other dayanim take, or against the minhag of the am, meaning that's a person who takes a position that has some sort of support, but it is in contrast to the conclusion of everyone else, and therefore it's a mistake in shikul hadat, in his judgment, or an error in judgment in this situation. So for two reasons over here, Rabbi Kiva says, Rabbi Tarfa, you don't have to pay out of pocket. Number one, your mistake is an obvious mistake, and therefore you could have reversed your position, and as such, you really didn't cause the loss. The loss was caused by the person doing it themselves. Number two is, even if it was shikul hadat, even if it was something that requires some discernment, you'd still be patur because of the fact that you have judicial immunity because you're a mumche debated. This is what the Gemara and Sanhedrin discusses when you're allowed to reverse a psak, when you're not allowed to reverse a psak. Because also by shikul hadat, why can't you reverse the psak? So there the Gemara talks about the fact that it will undermine the integrity of Beit Din if Beit Din backs away from it. So the Gemara over there sets up different scenarios where it will not undermine the integrity of Beit Din. So for instance, if you have a chacham who's greater than him, then in that case you can reverse the psak because you can go basically appeal to the bigger chacham, and the bigger chacham will say that he's wrong. Otherwise, the litigants can say, how do you know that what he's saying now is any different than what he's saying before? Why is the second one right, not the first one? When it comes to shikul hadat, it's going to start to cause problems with the integrity of Beit Din if he changes it, and therefore we force him to keep it, and he gets judicial immunity. But in cases where we can be told that the change on something else that doesn't undermine the integrity of Beit Din, then we will allow you to back out of the position or change your mind. So that the Gemara in Sanhedrin speaks about all those different scenarios where sometimes you are allowed, where you're not allowed. But over here, he couldn't change it, but he also had judicial immunity, and that's why he would have been patur over here. Hanotel sachar liot ru'et ha-bechorot. Someone who gets paid to see the momim in bechorot, ain't shokatin al-pib. You're not allowed to shecht based on that. If you have to pay to get the opinion of the chacham, you can't shecht on it. Ela, im ken hayam mumche, ki'ila b'yabna. Unless he was an expert, which is someone who had undergone certification. So unless he has certification like Ela of Yavna, she tirolo chachamim liot notel arba isarot beimadaka. The chachamim allowed him to get paid a fixed price of 4 isarot for a beimadaka, shisha legasa, and 6 for a large animal, ben tam ben balmum. Whether it's a tam or whether it's a balmum, he gets paid that fixed rate. Mary asks, my time. Why is it that there's a difference in price that he gets paid for the big animals and the small animals? He's just opining on the mum. Why should it matter? My answer is, hi, nafish tirche. I don't nafish tirche. It's more work. To look over a behemah gasa is more work. Either because it's a larger animal, you have to look it over. Or as Rashi says over here, you have to put it to the ground. You have to pin it down to the ground to look at it. It's not necessarily going to be cooperative. So therefore, the behemah gasa takes more work. The behemah daka is a lot easier to deal with. Ben tam or ben balmum, whether it's a tam or balmum, he got paid. Bishlama balmum ben tegashem dekashorile. The reason he gets paid when he declares it a mum is because he did something for the balim, so he deserves to get compensated. Elatam amai. When he declares it a tam, why does he get paid? He didn't do anything to benefit the balim. Why should he get paid for his services? Timkein ate le mikshade. That's because if he didn't get paid for a tam, people would then come to suspect his tiske alocha. Varmei hai balmum tamu. And they're going to be suspect him and say that this balmum is really a tam. And the reason he was matir it is because he wanted to get paid. They're going to say every time that he's saying that it's a mum because he wants to get paid. So what we did was we took that away. We say that no matter whether he declares it a mum or doesn't declare it a mum, he gets paid. That way you take away the factor of a success fee. Because if it's a success-based fee, then there's chashad that he's only doing it because he wants to get paid. But if he gets paid whether there's success or not, then there's no chashad that he's not going to give the right psak. So the says, "Ochi tam nami amre." So then, if that's the case, they're going to buy a tam when he declares that it's not a mum. People are going to say about him, "Ba mum, it really has a mum in it." Behind the loko sharile, the reason that he wasn't matter is saber ki echad lishkol agrei zim nachrite, because then he'll have to check it again, meaning that there'll have to be another time and he'll earn more money. In terms of chashad, there's a chashad in both directions. If you pay only for success, then there's a chashad that he's doing it or declaring it a ba mum to get paid. If you pay him irrespective of the outcome, then people are going to say, the reason he's saying that it's a tam is so that he gets more business, because he's going to have to check it again in the future. Mar says, no problem. Chad zimna takinu le rabbanan, trei zimna lo takinu le rabbanan. The Chachamim gave him the right to collect once, and not more than once. Rashi says here, after he declares it a tam, no matter how many times after that, they brought it to him, he'd have to check it for free, he doesn't have to get paid for it. So then you don't have that chashad anymore, because he's gonna only get paid once, irrespective of what the outcome is. So whether he says it's a tam, whether he says it is a baal mum, he gets paid. If it's a baal mum, he's not gonna see it again. If it's a tam, he's gonna see it again, but he's not gonna get compensated again. The Baal Tosafot would say, wait a minute, people are going to have this chashad, that he's going to declare it a baal mum, because he doesn't have to do it for free afterwards. If he declares it a tam, he'll get paid now, but now he's going to have to see it for free a bunch more times afterwards. If that's the case, he's going to save himself that work, and he's going to declare it a baal mum. So Tosafot says, either you have to say that the Chamim didn't obligate him to see it again. He got paid once. If he happens to take a look again, or they bring it to him again, he doesn't get paid for it. But the Chachamim didn't obligate him to see it again, so he can get out of doing this. But if you do see it, then he can't take payment for it. Or you could say, nobody's going to suspect that he's always going to be mati or something that's really a sur to save himself from having to see it a second time. That's a small amount of Torah to go ahead and then declare everything as being mutar b'mum, even though it's really a sur. It's too far-fetched already in terms of chashad, and they're not going to worry about it. But you can see over here, all the things that the Gemara is speaking about are these issues that we want it to be above reproach, where nobody can suspect that the Psak Halacha here has anything to do with the Chacham getting paid, and therefore we have to make the payment as neutral, as well as unbiased as possible. And we do that by having him getting paid no matter what the Psak gives, number one. And number two is, he gets paid only once, and not more than once, so therefore he has no benefit in either way declaring whether it's a tam or a baal mum. And that's the only way you can get paid. And again, that's only if you're certified and appointed by Beit Din. So you need all of these factors in order to get paid for such a psak halacha. And then we're going to get to this in the next Mishnah as to when you're allowed to take compensation and not take compensation in these types of situations. Okay, I'm going to stop here by the Mishnah on Chavtet Amud Aleph.